Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Dr. Rob Stone. Rob is an emergency room physician at Bloomington Hospital and the assistant clinical professor of emergency medicine at Indiana University. He is also the director and co-founder of Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plan. A native Hoosier, he has emerged as one of Indiana's most outspoken advocates for making healthcare accessible to everyone. Hi, Rob. Welcome to Profiles.
Thank you.
Talk to me a little bit, Rob, about how you decided to become a physician. What pulled you into medicine?
Well, I come from a family of lawyers, so that must have something to do with it. My father, both my grandfathers, an older brother, all became lawyers. But somewhere in high school, a lot of things were going on, and I decided that maybe medicine would be the thing that I'd want to do. And then I had this conversation with my father, and this was probably in the spring of my senior year as we're getting ready to choose colleges and things like that. And he told me, much to my surprise, that he had intended, that he had actually been a pre-med when he was an undergraduate at Harvard, and then due to some pressure from his father, who was a lawyer, as I mentioned, he had decided to go to medical school – excuse me, to go to law school instead of medical
school. And gave up medical school.
Gave up medical school. And I'd never heard any of this until I brought up that I was interested in medicine. So it was very interesting.
Maybe a little bit hereditary?
Maybe so.
Why emergency room medicine?
That's kind of a long and complicated story. But it happened partly because I've always been attracted to the pace in the emergency room. And, of course, one of the great things about working in the ER is that you, when you're done, you're done. It's a shift and it's over and you don't have to take it home. But actually, my original training was in family practice in Colorado. I trained in family practice, and I did that for a few years in Denver. I worked in the barrio in a indigent clinic with mostly a Hispanic clientele, and did that for about 3 years. And then we moved back here to Indiana, and a friend of mine got me a job at Bloomington Hospital, and so I started working ER then, and kind of never looked back.
What do you love about the ER? You mentioned the pace. How would you describe the pace? You know, we see shows like ER on TV, which makes it look like it's always moving a million miles an hour. But
well, actually, of course, the pace drives me crazy sometimes, too, because it's such a multitasking thing. I think it helps to have a little ADD maybe to jump from patient to patient and do whatever takes needing to be done. Maybe the pace isn't even quite right, but I like being able to address a problem and get it worked up and try to get it figured out and set up a treatment plan and a trajectory to move towards, all at once. I like being able to pull it all together instead of think, well, we'll schedule you for this and we'll schedule you for that and I'll see you back in 2 weeks. That's part of what I like about the pace, actually, is the not so much the pace, the hectic pace of a busy ER, but more the way in which we can address problems in a way that doesn't feed my impatience, even though my patients are impatient waiting because I'm addressing one person's problem and there's another person waiting for their problems to be addressed.
So when you talk about that notion of problem solving, it's really interesting because how else does that apply to other areas of your life? I mean, that seems sort of like a philosophy as much as an approach to work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's certainly one of the fun parts about medicine as a profession is that it's all about problem solving and new problems and always needing to be creative and never boring, never repetitive.
So I'm guessing that you like things to be different.
I guess so.
What are some of the things you do outside of medicine to keep yourself really challenged?
Well, balance is something I'm always looking for. And so the ER is such an intense place and, no windows is always something that is hard. And fluorescent lights. So being outdoors is then where I always go next. And we live in the woods just north of Bloomington, and we have a little lake. And so things to do with the woods and with water, whether it's hiking, swimming, or sailing, or biking, those are the kind of things that really help keep me in balance.
Now, I heard you built your house yourself. Is that true?
No, not really.
No, not true.
No, okay. I was involved, very much involved in the process of designing it, but I was working in the ER to pay the carpenters.
I got it. Okay. Rob, your experience in the emergency room led you to recognize some real dire needs in the community in terms of accessing health care. Can you talk a little bit about how that came about?
The emergency room is clearly part of what we call the safety net because it's really the only place universally across the country where anybody can be seen irregardless of their insurance status or, you know, whatever's going on. You know, 24/7, and it doesn't matter whether you've got any money in your pocket or not. So
you must see somebody, right? It doesn't matter if they have insurance
right.
or if they have – even without identification, you would
right.
be required.
Exactly. It's a federal law that we have to see everybody. And unfortunately, we also do send everybody a bill. But we are the safety net. We are kind of the bottom, you know, that catches people. One of the things that has come up is that a very – prestigious organization called the Institute of Medicine, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, did a study in 2003 about what happens to people who don't have insurance in this country. And they can certainly go to the emergency room, but they estimated that back then about 18,000 people a year die in this country, and they basically assigned their cause of death to be lack of insurance and then the lack of access to health care that comes from not having health insurance.
So it would be that they wouldn't go in for treatment
right.
if they found themselves ill and the illness would progress.
They would postpone treatment. They wouldn't go in for treatment. They would ignore signs and symptoms that they shouldn't ignore. They'd be afraid of the bill or whatever reason. They had 18,000 people a year dying totally preventably. That was their assessment. These are people who had things that could have been prevented, could have been taken care of, but because they didn't have access, because they didn't have insurance, they died. And 18,000 a year, if you know, do some quick math back, that's about 3,000 people every couple of months. Where else did we see 3,000 people die in the World Trade Center? If these people were dying in front of us in a dramatic sort of fashion, then I think we'd all be, you know, in the streets with forks, pitchforks and torches and saying we've got to do something about this. But instead, they're all dying in the background. And so I see that in the emergency room all the time. I see from, you know, a whole spectrum of people with life-threatening illnesses that they haven't taken care of. And at the other end of the spectrum, people who come in, and this is just so common, who've been, you know, walking on a painful swollen ankle for a couple of days, and they say, Doc, I'm worried my ankle's broken. And I say, yeah, it's really swollen, looks really painful, and we better get an X-ray on it. And they say, oh, do you have to get an X-ray on it? I said, well, yeah, that's what I have to do. I'm really worried about the bill. And then sometimes, you know, what started out to be just a little hairline crack in the bone, now that they've been walking on it for a couple of days, has started to shift, and now it's going to need surgery and things like that.
So have there also been studies done on what the actual cost is for someone to not be treated for something that might start out as a, you know, respiratory infection but leads to pneumonia, or a hairline fracture that leads to a really bad break and ends up, of course, becoming a much more complex problem to solve, let alone the effects that that might have on the individual or their family?
Well, there's been a lot of research on this, and it turns out it's actually much more controversial than you would think, because it makes so much intuitive sense that if you treat things early and prevent the really complicated problems from developing, that would save money. It's clearly the right thing to do. Does it actually save money? That turns out to be a fairly difficult question to answer, because when you keep people alive longer, then they live longer to have more problems down the road. So in individual cases, there's no question it's a huge cost saving. And in terms of a person's life and how functional they are and how happy they are, it's a huge issue, the preventative things. But in terms of saving money for society, that's an interesting question, because it's been a little hard to prove that, even though if you listen to some of the presidential candidates and all, they all say, we're going to save money by prevention. It makes good sense. But when you talk to the policy wonk people, then you find out that it's a little harder to actually prove that it's the right thing to do. But will it actually save us a whole lot of money? That's more debatable.
You're listening to Profiles, and our guest is Dr. Rob Stone. Rob, how did you move from an awareness to deciding that you had to take action? Was there, you know, one event that sort of tipped you over, or was it a continuous process?
I think it was more of a continuous process. I can't really identify a specific event. I was interested in these issues really from the start of my medical practice, and I think that's part of the reason why I worked in an indigent care clinic in Denver right after I finished my medical training. And so it's been in my mind here since I came here in 1983. I joined a national physicians organization called Physicians for a National Health Program, or PNHP. I joined that organization 10 or 15 years ago, and they've really inspired me in a lot of ways. So it's just kind of been one thing leading to another. But in terms of really speaking out, I think it goes back to an event that happened here in Bloomington. I think it'll be 3 or 4 years. I think maybe it'll even be 4 years ago this June. There was a national event called Bridging the Gap.
Back about 2004.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. And it was a national event that there was going to be a local demonstration was called, a local physician in Bloomington, Mary Mahern, was really the key person setting all that up. And she had heard me speak before on other subject and asked me to speak. And so I gave a little talk about the myths of universal health care and the myths of our current system, and it went very well. And I felt good about it, and I got lots of positive feedback. And then out of that talk, someone who heard it talked to someone else, and then I was invited to speak at St. Vincent's Hospital in Indianapolis and present what's called a grand rounds or a presentation for the whole medical staff. And then kind of one thing led to another, to another, to another.
How, in general, and I know there's probably going to be lots of different answers to this, how do physicians in general receive the idea that there needs to be some kind of universal health care, some kind of universal access for people?
Physicians get it more and more. And in fact, there's some very recent data that was just released the first week of April. The physicians, of course, tend to be a relatively conservative bunch. And any change that we face potentially affects our lives in deep ways, particularly our pocketbooks. The best study of physician attitudes before last week was a study published in 2003 and was done by a doctor from IU Med School in Indianapolis, Aaron Carroll. And it showed that at that time, when asked, and this was a national poll mm-hmm. of physicians, when asked, would you favor a government plan of national health insurance to cover everyone? At that time, published in 2003, it was 49% in favor. And so we just repeated the study last year and just published it. And now this breaking news is it's gone from 49% to 59% of physicians in favor of some sort of national health insurance to cover everyone.
Well, I'm guessing you're an optimist because to hear over a 5-year or 4-year period that there's only been a 10% growth does not necessarily fill me with optimism. And yet you sounded very optimistic hearing that.
I'm very positive about that because physicians have not necessarily across the board been in the leadership on this. I've met some resistance from fellow physicians. The general populace tends to be more 65 to 30, more 2-to-1 in favor of universal health care. But the physicians are a little behind that. I've traveled all over the state now talking to physician groups. I've spoken in Fort Wayne and Terre Haute and Indianapolis, in New Albany and Evansville, Bedford and Bloomington. And physician groups, physicians who I speak to, uniformly, after they've heard me talk, say, you know, that makes sense. Let's and anecdotally, you know, just talking to different doctors, you know, people come up to me in the ER where I see lots of my colleagues, and people whom I know to be fairly conservative people, kind of socially, politically, will say things like, you know, Rob, I didn't used to agree with what you're talking about, but now I think you're right.
You mentioned before that you gave a talk on some of the myths of healthcare. What are some of those myths?
Ooh, now you're getting me started. Well, one of the myths is that our healthcare system is just in need of a little bit of tinkering, a little bit of reform. You know, maybe we need to do a little something about malpractice, and maybe we need to change the tax code a little bit, and a few little things here and there. And I think, you know, when you look at how bad our situation is, I think, no, we really need some major reform. The tinkering, the time for tinkering is fast coming to an end.
And just to pull, because I think you have these facts at your fingertips, what's the percentage of the American population that has no insurance or has no coverage at all at this point?
Right now, we're looking at about 47 million Americans. That's about 17% of the population. It's just, you know, such a large number, it's just hard to even conceive.
And a very large group of those are children, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. Large group of those are children. I forget how many millions it is, but of the uninsured, about of the 47 million, it's something like 18 or 19% of those are children. The people who have insurance, one of the myths is that these are mostly, you know, lazy people who deserve not having insurance or something like that. The people without insurance are mostly working families. About 80% of the uninsured live in a family where there's at least one full-time worker. And sometimes people are working two or three different jobs, but either there's no insurance offered. More and more employers are not offering insurance or are requiring so much contribution from the employees that the employees simply can't afford it. And then, of course, there are people who have pre-existing conditions and things like that and simply can't get insured in our system.
And some of the other myths about you mentioned that it's not just a little bit of tinkering that it needs, and also the fact that those that are not insured very often are in families where at least one person's working. What are some of the other myths that we have about healthcare?
Well, one of the other big ones is, well, then we can't afford to take care of everybody, that it would be just too expensive. And to understand that, we need to look a little bit at other countries. Because if you look at the other countries that are kind of our peer countries, like England, France, Germany, Japan, Australia, countries like that, all of these countries spend per capita, so it's all divided out, you know, per person per year, about half or even less than half of what we spend. And all these countries have basically universal coverage, 99 to 100% of their population covered. So where's all our money going? We're spending the most in the world. So the other myth is, do we have the best health care in the world? And this is one you hear all the time. People will say, well, we've got the best health care in the world, and we wouldn't want to mess that up. Sadly, if we've got the best health care in the world, then, and I think a lot of the readers, the listeners, have heard this by now, by any objective measurement that you want to choose, we don't have the best health care in the world. And, you know, you can take things like life expectancy, which is a rough measure, but we rank 41st in the world in life expectancy. If you look at infant mortality, which much more closely really represents the performance of a healthcare system, again, we're down in the 40s. The World Health Organization does a global ranking of the world's healthcare system. We're ranked 37th by the World Health Organization. The Commonwealth Fund has done more sophisticated analyses of our healthcare delivery system, and we always either rank poorly or at best mediocre, whether it's cancer care, heart care. We have access to the best healthcare in the world here if you have good insurance and have the money to do it. But our healthcare system performs very poorly on all objective measures.
What keeps you optimistic?
I'm optimistic probably partly just kind of constitutionally. I'm optimistic because one of my heroes is a physician in Chicago named Quentin Young. And he says he's, I think, 89 now. And he says what's he want on his tombstone? That he was a dangerous optimist. And so he inspires me. I think in a lot of ways, universal health care is inevitable. Every other country, every other wealthy democracy, every other industrialized country has come to the same conclusion. My concerns are, how bad is it going to have to get? How low a bottom are we going to have to reach before we really get there? But like I said, that when you poll the American populace, and this has been done over and over again, 2-1 in favor. Doctors now, a majority are in favor. Business people are coming around. Obviously, there are powerful moneyed interests who right now are making a lot of money. And I said we're spending more than any other country, about twice as much as the other wealthy democracies, and yet we're not getting a whole lot for it with 47 million uninsured. Where is that money going? Well, a huge amount of it is going to the for-profit insurance industry.
How is it spent by the insurance industry? Is it money that people are paying in and then not using for medical care, or
exactly.
How does that work?
Exactly. If you compare the United States overhead expense, billing expenses and administrative expenses and so on, we spend about 31% of our healthcare dollars on just the administrative end of it. 31%. So that means only 70% about approximately is being spent on healthcare, and the rest is on administration. If you look at how much that is, you can break it out per capita. It's published a few years ago. It was about $1,400 per person per year was just being spent on administration, whereas in Canada, they were spending $400 per person per year on administration. So $1,000 per person per year more just on the administrative side of our healthcare system than the Canadians. If we could run our system as efficiently as the Canadian system, which interestingly enough runs about as efficiently as our Medicare system, we could save in 2007 dollars somewhere in the neighborhood of $350 billion just by the administrative efficiency. And so why is that? And, I'm a college graduate, and I have a great difficulty figuring out my own medical bills. And I think a lot of the listeners can relate to that. And you get these sheets of paper that say, this is not a bill, EOB, explanation of benefits, and then more and more. And then you get another bill a month later and say, oh, I didn't realize I was going to have to also pay the anesthesiologist and then another bill. What's this even for? And our billing system is so complicated. Well, you think about it. I mean, there are armies of people sitting in cubicles who are trying to deny claims, and there are armies of people trying to figure out who's eligible for what program and so on. And then, of course, in every doctor's office, it used to be the doctor, the nurse, and the receptionist And now it's the doctor, the nurse, the receptionist, and the back room where they process the insurance claims. It's so, so complicated. The hospital has a huge billing department, and other countries simply don't do this. And the model that I would propose we use is the one we already know. It's Medicare. You know, Medicare runs about 3% overhead. It is a universal, everybody's covered insurance program for people age 65 and above. We've had it for over 40 years. It isn't perfect, but it works pretty well. Doctors find Medicare relatively easy to bill. Hospitals find Medicare relatively easy to bill. Like I said, it's not perfect, but it's a tremendously good model to base reform on.
How do you address people's fear that if we went to that kind of a model, they wouldn't get good health care? Because that's something that I think we hear a lot.
That's kind of the crux of the issue in a lot of ways. People without insurance are people who are really afraid they're going to lose their insurance. They get it, of course, immediately. We've got to change. But people who say, you know, what's in it for me? I don't want to give up my good insurance if there's a chance that I'm going to lose something by going to a universal system. And there are a couple ways to look at that. One is that, of course, it hurts all of us to have 47 million uninsured and another 40 or some million underinsured, to have, you know, sick people everywhere who are cutting into our productivity and you know, making us sick too, making our health statistics so bad, dragging our economy down. So there's something in it for all of us if on a very concrete level, not to mention just the sense of maybe it is the right thing to do, and maybe we should have a level playing field in this country where you know, everybody has access to health care and we take care of each other, brother's keeper, sister's keeper. But I think also, you know, you can look at Medicare again, and you know, it is not true that when people turn age 65 that suddenly their health goes down and that they have trouble finding a doctor and that they have trouble getting to the hospital and getting things taken care of. You know, actually, people's health improves. There was an interesting study last year that showed that people's health improves when they turn age 65 because a lot of people lose their insurance for one reason or another in their 60s. Almost impossible to get insurance in your 60s. If your spouse, for instance, is particularly a problem for women, because if a woman, I saw a woman the other day, actually, I mean, I'm talking just 10 days ago, I saw a woman mm-hmm. in the emergency room who'd been divorced a couple years ago, and she's in her early 60s, and there's no way that she could get insurance.
Because she had been on her husband's insurance
exactly.
before that, and now she
and
has
now
no
she's
insurance.
She's holding on to age 65. So she comes into the ER with so short of breath she can't even walk to the bathroom. She can't lay flat. She feels like her heart's beating out of her chest. She breaks out in a sweat when she stands up. She was really sick. Now, that's you know, not an unusual thing to see in the emergency room. She'd had it 4 days. And because she didn't have insurance, she kept hoping she was going to get better. She was in a condition called atrial fibrillation. And that, I mean, I just see this all the time. So particularly a problem for women because if their husband also is a few years older and retires at age 65, his insurance may likely no longer cover her. So she falls into this gap. So there are a lot of women in their 60s and a lot of men as well who – for whatever reason, lose their health insurance in their 60s. And then by the time they turn 65, then they go on Medicare. Then they can start getting taken care of. Their health improves. Interesting study that looked at that last summer.
Wow. Rob, I wanted to turn a little bit and take a little break and listen to Ripple by the Grateful Dead. Why that song?
Well, when I was just starting medical school, I lived in a big house in Vermont that also was how I shared it with a rock and roll band that that only played Grateful Dead songs. That's all they did.
This is in the 70s, I take
this
it.
This is in the early 70s. And I got a great love for this song, which is really not a rock and roll song. It's a folk song. And so we could you know, maybe hear it and then see what we think afterward.
if my words did glow with the gold of sunshine, and my tunes were played on the harp unstrung. Would you hear my voice come through the music? Would you hold?
We were listening to Ripple by the Grateful Dead, and you're listening to Profiles on WFIU. Our guest is Rob Stone. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter. Rob, we were talking about some of the myths of medicine, and Karen, you were talking a little bit about some of the experiences you've had in the emergency room. When you think about sort of pivotal experiences that you've had in the emergency room for yourself or for those that you've worked with, what would some of those be? Share some stories with me.
You know, like I said before, it's such a spectrum. You know, it's from these little things like, you know, people coming in with a little laceration that they've waited a couple of days because they were afraid, they didn't want to get stitches because they couldn't afford it, to the problems with heart attacks. There's a fellow that whose story I often tell because it was such a crystallization of so many of the problems. And this was a couple summers ago. A gentleman came into the ER who was on a medium busy Saturday afternoon here in Bloomington, and he was being wheeled in behind me. I was standing at the desk writing on the chart, and I could just kind of see out of the corner of my eye that this guy didn't look very good. And so I try to quickly finish what I'm doing, and sure enough, a minute later, I hear the page, Dr. Stone, level 1 chest pain, room 11, and I go right in there. And so here's this fella in his mid-50s, and they're putting him up on the gurney, and he looks bad. He's pale and sweaty and kind of clutching his chest and short of breath, and it's clear that something bad's going on, and so there's a lot going on. So somebody's putting oxygen on him, and there's a nurse trying to start an IV, and somebody's hooking him up to the heart monitor and the EKG machine, and I almost have to kind of elbow my way in a little bit to talk to him, and I say, so you're having chest pain? He said, yeah. And when did it start? Oh, about 2 or 3 hours ago. And what's it feel like? Is it sharp? Is it dull? And at that point, he kind of interrupts me and says, Doc, this pain is bad, but it's not as bad as the pain I had 2 nights ago. I said, 2 nights ago? What happened then? And he said, oh, it was like an elephant sitting on my chest, and I was sweating buckets, and I was puking my guts out, and I couldn't breathe. And I said, well, why didn't you come to the hospital 2 nights ago? He said, I don't have insurance, and I was afraid of the bill. And this is a guy who lost his job a couple years earlier, and so he'd stopped taking his high blood pressure pills and his diabetes pills. He was diabetic, but not on insulin. So, you know, he was taking pills, maybe a couple dollars a day worth of pills, but he'd been off of them for a couple years because he'd lost his insurance and lost his job. You know, pretty quickly there, they hand me his EKG, and it's clear he's having an acute heart attack. And so we kicked into even higher gear, and we rushed him upstairs to the cardiac catheterization laboratory, where they threaded a little wire into his heart and found the blood vessel that was blocked, and they opened it up and put a stent in, and that was all marvelous and remarkable. While they're in there, while they're working on his heart, they took pictures of his heart, and although they opened up the blood vessel that was causing this heart attack, they could see that a big part of his heart muscle was dead, was just flabby, that it had died in the heart attack 2 days before, because that's what he'd had. He'd had a heart attack 2 days before, and he'd stayed home with it. And, of course, all the high-tech stuff that we can do nowadays doesn't bring that back.
It has to be within a certain amount of time to be able to
right.
Do that.
Right. Well, actually, about 3 hours. So this guy, we got the second heart attack, we got stopped because we got him just in time to do that. But the other one, 2 days later, there's nothing that can be done at this point with all our technology. I kept thinking about this guy because it was, you know, such a stark case. About 6 months later, I went into the computer and looked him up again. And I checked his bill. 2 hours in the cardiac cath lab, 2 nights in the hospital, $40,000, It's a pretty good sized bill. And so I got his phone number and I called him up. And he was really glad to hear from me. I don't think he had a real clear picture of me, actually, because he was pretty sick in the ER and he wasn't there very long. But he said, Doc, I'm doing great. I get out and I'm trying to take care of myself. I'm taking my medicine. I get out and walk every day. I can't walk real far because I get short of breath. But you know, things are pretty good. And I asked him, so I know you were really worried about your bill. How'd that all work out? And he said, oh, it was fine. Turns out, because he stayed home with the first heart attack and now has permanent heart damage, he qualified for Medicaid disability while he was in the hospital, and they're covering his bills now. It's a tough way to get insured. And if he died, he would have been clearly one of those 18,000 that we mentioned before, you know, just lost and forgotten.
So when you started Hoosiers for a Common Sense health plan, I'm guessing these incidents and experiences that you had were part of your motivation for that. How did you decide to start a local statewide group?
Well, that was that was it. I was feeling motivated and wanted to make it, you know, bigger than just Bloomington. I formed it actually with another Bloomington professor, Milton Fisk, and with an orthopedic surgeon from Indianapolis named Chris Stack. And the three of us got together and said, let's form a state group. And now our group is all over the state. We have very active chapters, of course, Bloomington and Indianapolis, but also Fort Wayne and New Albany. And we've got early chapters in Terre Haute and Evansville. I'm going to Lafayette in a few weeks to give a talk there. We're traveling around the state a fair amount. There's plenty to do.
What's your hope?
My hope is that by old-fashioned grassroots, really, that we can build even more support because, you know, people get it, although they get it much better if they can really hear it explained to them. It takes a little bit of time to understand why this is so important and to counter some, to have the information to counter some of those myths. And so what we want to do is convince members of the Indiana House delegation to support the bill in Congress called H.R. 676, which is the Medicare for All bill that has about 80 co-sponsors in the House right now. And so we want to work in every congressional district. And we also want to work at the state legislature level to move forward with looking for what can we do at the state level.
I asked you before how you kept optimistic. Let me ask you now how you maintain your patience with the way policy moves very, very slowly in terms of creating political change.
Well, part of that is, you know, things just kind of – even though things move slowly, they do tend to kind of build. And so, you know, you get one thing done, you get one person behind you, you move forward. Sometimes there's some steps back, but – you know, progress, not perfection. That's kind of what I look for. And so that's good. And also, you know, I've just seen so much change just in the last couple of years because when I first started giving my talks and all, it seemed like the debate was really framed between should we do anything? Should we just leave things kind of the way they are, or should we move towards universal care? And now the way the debate's really being framed is what's the best way to get to universal care? And so that's a tremendous shift. And you just don't know, you know, what those tipping points are going to be. So I keep moving forward thinking that, number one, it's inevitable. Number two, it just makes so much sense. And number three, I'm having fun doing this because it's exciting, rewarding, fulfilling. It's good.
What makes it exciting, rewarding, and fulfilling for you?
I think because I'm not really, you know, doing this to make a buck. It more feels like this is, you know, part of my purpose. You know, purpose and meaning. It's the right thing. It makes sense, and it's the big thing what I'm doing in my life right now. I'm working in the ER just 2 days a week so that I've got more time to travel around the state and do whatever it takes.
One of the myths that you didn't talk about but that I've heard pretty commonly is that doctors don't want to give up their great incomes. Yet a lot of doctor friends that I have that are in private practice or have small family practices say that it's become really hard to make ends meet because they spend so much time battling with the insurance company. Where's the truth? Where does it lie in between those two statements?
One of my good friends here in Bloomington, who's a primary care doctor, says that the time she used to spend doing her continuing education now is all spent battling with insurance companies. And I hear those kind of stories all the time, all the time. And there's a couple different ways to look at that question. Certainly, doctors' incomes are very important. I mean, my income is important to me. And, you know, if we're going to take care of 47 more million people, we're going to need more doctors as well as more nurses and respiratory therapists and so on. And so if we're going to get people to go into medicine as opposed to, you know, law school or business school, there's going to have to be an attractive income for doctors or else, you know, it simply won't work. And so that's really – so fixing that is pretty straightforward as far as I can tell. Now, right now, you know, doctors in this country are probably the best paid doctors in the world. I think that's, you know, that's fairly clear. Although if you look at doctor incomes in the United States versus Canada, it's interesting to make some comparisons there because as the Canadian dollar has appreciated against the U.S. dollar, Canadian doctors' incomes are very close to U.S. doctor incomes, extremely close.
The other argument I hear in there is that doctors in other parts of the world do not finish med school with $100,000.
A huge difference
from paying tuition.
Average debt, I believe, from Indiana University Medical School for in-state students is $120,000 right now, and for private schools, it's much higher. In Canada, they actually have they subsidize medical education, so people don't graduate with huge debt, and maybe partly as a result of that, or maybe because the Canadian system is actually fairly pleasant for a physician to practice in. They have almost twice as many applicants per medical school place as we do. It's much more competitive to get into medical school in Canada than it is in the United States. One more myth is that a lot of Canadian doctors come to the United States. That certainly was true for many years after they instituted their national system in the late 60s. However, that trend has actually reversed over the last 3 years, and now the net migration of physicians is from the United States to Canada. And an anecdote, a colleague of mine who's an emergency physician up in the northern part of Indiana, he's from Ontario originally. A lot of his family is still in Ontario, and he told me a year or two ago that actually as soon as his youngest kid finishes college, he's moving back to Ontario because it'll be so much more pleasant. The malpractice climate's better. You don't have to deal with the insurance companies. He's looking forward to moving back to Canada.
Tell me a little bit about if you had a immediate goal for the next year of your work with the Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plan, what do you hope to accomplish in the next year or so?
Well, short term, of course, so much is at stake with the presidential election coming up, and there's such a focus on health care right now. And so although our short-term goal is the same as our long-term goal, we want to move Indiana in the legislature next year to continue considering doing something in Indiana that would be a universal plan for the state of Indiana, and we want to continue working with our congressional legislators to do something at the national level. I think it's all kind of pretty continuous.
And what do you think is your most powerful tool to accomplish that?
Well, I think it is just looking at the facts. I mean, we're really pretty data-driven. You can look at this as a moral issue, but you can look at it as the data that, you know, we do have 17% of the population without insurance. It is stifling our economy. It is making us sick, sicker and dying younger and suffering more and less productive. All these facts, they just keep lining up one after the other. It's pretty compelling.
How do you rate that with the notion that we're supposed to take care of each other? I think I've read something that you wrote that in America there's an ideal that we take care of each other as neighbors. We take care of our neighbors. And yet at the same time, we're also a nation that really stresses each individual needs to succeed on their own. How do you rectify those two?
Right, and it's a matter of balance. And some people say, oh, yes, you just want to, we want the government to take care of all of us and we need to take care of ourselves. And absolutely we need to take care of ourselves. I mean, my best patients are the ones who want to make some changes in their lives and take care of themselves. So it's got to be a balance. The thing I want to do is I want to get rid of some of the middle people, and that's primarily the for-profit insurance industry, which I think now is really a parasite on the system. And I want to just have it so that we can get health care paid for universally, everyone can have access, and we can figure out ways to encourage people to take better care of themselves, because that's always going to be so important.
And just to play devil's advocate for a moment, what happens with those jobs in the insurance agencies?
It's a very good question.
What do we do with it about those people?
Yeah. Yeah. The bill in front of Congress that I mentioned before, H.R. 676, has within it a job retraining component. Currently, again, if we're going to take care of 47 million people who currently aren't getting any care, we're going to need more people at every level. There are a lot of people working in the insurance industry who could be retrained, and that's addressed in this bill because there are, for instance, a lot of nurses who work in the insurance industry right now, and they could come back and do some nursing. There are a lot of people who understand a lot of medical terminology who could maybe become more clinically involved. So retraining those people is important. Now, on the other hand, the CEO of Anthem in Indianapolis in 2003, his bonus was $42.5 million. That was his bonus on top of his salary. We're not going to, take care of him very well, but I think he can take care of himself.
Rob, with all the work you do between teaching and working in the emergency room and speaking on behalf of universal health care or health care access for everyone, you mentioned that some of the things you do for relax is outside things, being in the country. What do you read?
Well, this is sad. I've become such a health policy geek that I subscribe to the journal Health Affairs now, which is good bedtime reading. There's a great book called Healthcare Meltdown, which is out in a new edition. It's by a new edition by one of my heroes, a conservative evangelical Republican doctor from Colorado named Rocky White. I've gotten kind of stuck reading healthcare policy. Sad to say.
No mysteries, no fiction, no novels, no poetry.
I still reach for Walt Whitman and some other poetry sometimes when I need that for a little balance.
What's a favorite Whitman poem of yours? I'm not going to make you recite it.
Leaves of Grass, of course. But my favorite is a poem that I wouldn't recite, but I can describe. It's called a Noiseless Patient Spider. And it's a fairly short, somewhat obscure poem in one of the Leaves of Grass editions, but not in the long work called Leaves of Grass. And it talks about a spider whom Whitman observes shooting out little filaments of web out into space. And the spider shoots them out one after another, and then finally one catches. And then the spider can make use of that. And then Whitman talks about turns it to himself and says, "And you, O my soul, sitting in measureless realms of space, seeking the spheres to connect them until the ductile anchor hold and you pull and the world comes together." Is so much of what I do is I'm just kind of shooting little filaments out. I'm sending an email out here. I'm sending a press release out there. I'm giving a talk here and there. And sometimes things connect. And that's pretty exciting.
Rob, thank you so much for joining me on Profiles. I really appreciate having you on as a guest.
It's been my pleasure.
And we're going to listen to, on our way out, one of my favorite songs of all time, Moondance by Van Morrison. Why Moondance, Rob?
It's one of my favorites, too. It's kind of a jazzy, swingy, just a lovely image.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance, with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance, neath the cover of October skies. With all the leaves on the trees are falling, to the sound of the breezes that blow. Yet I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings that play soft and low. Yet all the night's magic seemed to whisper and hush. Yet all the soft moonlight seems to shine in your blush. Can I just have one more moon dance with you, my love? Can I just make some more?
The program you have just heard was recorded in April of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.